You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Sam.
Hey, Bob. How are you?
I'm good. Let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. I am also, and this is relevant to what we're going to talk about, author of the new book on AI, The God Test, chapter excerpts of which, along with the entire introductory chapter, can be found at thegodtest.net. But enough about me, Sam. Let's talk about you. You are, among other things, AI Policy Director at the Foundation for American Innovation. Is that part correct?
Yep.
And is it fair to say that that's a think tank with libertarian leanings, or would you rather it not be stereotyped?
Most free libertarians.
Market. An appreciation of the power of the free market, let's say.
I think even that is a little too pigeonholy. We're fairly heterodox, but center right is fair.
But saying utter disdain for free markets would be going too far in the other direction.
Probably.
Okay. So now you yourself, I characterized you on Twitter just the other day as implicitly as libertarian, and you retweeted me, so you must not object to that label for yourself. Or do you just figure all publicity is good publicity?
No, I mean, I came up through the libertarian side of things. Students for Liberty, I was at the Mercatus Center, George Mason University. I did a degree at George Mason. I was around that Tyler Cowen, Robin Hanson, Brian Kaplan ecosystem. But I think it's just sort of narcissism, a small difference, because you know, a lot of libertarians would consider me a statist. And it's really...
You said are considered statist, or...
Would consider me a statist.
Would consider you a statist, yeah. Because you do favor some degree of regulation?
Yeah, and I've written about industrial policy, and I've written about the pro-market case for the welfare state, and other things that are anathema to traditional libertarians.
Because I should say, we're going to talk about a number of AI things, including the question of whether AIs do now or will someday have consciousness, you know, sentience, subjective experience. You recently wrote a thing on your periodically updated Substack, which is called what? Second Best?
Mm-hmm.
About arguing that we should take the consciousness prospect seriously. I agree. I think I agree for reasons other than the reasons that are central to your argument. So I want to get into all that eventually. But I also want to get into recent developments, and I'm going to do this first, on the in AI discourse, where you are a prominent contributor. You're a well-known figure on Twitter, where your handle is Ham and Cheese. One word, I've long speculated that may be a play on your last name, Hammond, but...
We'll never know.
It could have just been that you were having a psychotic episode when you joined Twitter. So anyway, the tweet my tweet that was a kind of compliment to you, I thought, was after you referred to this so-called Pacing the Frontier letter, which I want to talk about. Very important development. I think you and I would agree, a pretty important development where tons of very well-known, prominent people in the AI business called for, at least in some sense, preparing the ground for possibly eventually trying to slow the pace of AI development. That's not exactly the way they put it, but I think that's a fair read of what they were suggesting. It included the chief scientific officers at OpenAI, Anthropic, Google DeepMind, Meta. So it's an important thing, over 1,000 signatures. And anyway, you were defending it, and I tweeted that this is what distinguishes a thoughtful libertarian from a kind of, you know, billionaire talking your book libertarian. I will not mention any podcasts that are called All In or anything like that, but or any other billionaires, but that was a compliment. That's what you retweeted, and I do mean it as a compliment. You've always been very thoughtful about AI. In fact, early on, you were kind of ahead of the game. I mean, I know that several years ago, when I first got interested in the discourse, you had a particular kind of plan for, you know, channeling the consequences of AI. We don't need to get into that. It's probably not something you're touting anymore.
It's sort of relevant.
Okay,
You're thinking of my Politico essay, Manhattan Project for AI Safety,
mm-hmm.
which was, I think, sometime in early 2023. Mm-hmm. And, you know, part of that plan was talking about the need for the leading companies to at some point have some kind of joint partnership to mutually evaluate dangerous capabilities, mm-hmm. to sort of check each other's power. And, you know, I think, like, logistically, that was the right time to start talking about that idea, because politics and policy take time to mature. Mm-hmm. But it was almost too ahead of the curve for where capabilities were, because a lot of people thought it was just a non sequitur, like, you know, these are just language models, yada, yada, yada. And now, like, with the Pacing of the Frontier proposal and other proposals around this, we're starting to, like, the FINRA thing that Demis Hassabis has suggested. These are sort of versions of this, of, like, the labs have to somehow solve their collective action problem, mm-hmm. and begin either pacing development or checking each other's work, and having means of verifying.
Now, to me, the interesting difference between what I take to be the Hassabis proposal, although I haven't read it, and the Pacing the Frontier letter, is that although I'm sure the Hassabis proposal was more thoroughly worked out in terms of details, I don't think did it make any reference to the need for international coordination? That was what struck me about the Pacing letter.
No, I don't believe so. It's not really that worked out either. It just referenced FINRA, which is a law dealing with securities and financial regulation.
Okay.
Essentially, SEC is allowed to create these self-regulatory organizations that set accounting standards, financial standards, and the banks and so forth pay into it, and they sort of police themselves. The NASDAQ is an SRO. It was gesturing at this notion that we need some kind of self-regulatory organization for the labs to regulate themselves in a way that's, mm-hmm. like, contractually binding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm trying to find the wording of the Pacing the Frontier letter. This only came out a week or so ago. It's a fresh thing, and it emanates from, I think, what you and I would agree is a growing sense for months now within kind of the AI community or the AI discourse community, to include both, you know, AI accelerationists and AI doomers and just people who think about it generally, a growing sense of acceleration, that things are moving faster and faster. It seems pretty self-evident to me, and yet there are lots of people, I'm not one to complain about reviews of my book actually I am, but anyway, there was this review in the New Republic, which I will refrain from expressing all of my views about, but was, you know, it was still on this, like, AI is just a tool, and kind of mocking the idea that any kind of, like, superintelligence could emerge. And I just thought, man, look, superintelligence in various senses of the word, I guess, may or may not emerge. But I really do think we're past the point where the facile reassurance that, you know, this is just a tool, like, you know, the pile driver or something, is really, you know, we don't really have time for that. Anyway, the wording of this Pacing letter was, calls on the U.S. government to, quote, support an international effort to develop the technical and governance tools needed to deliberately pace the frontier of automated AI development. Now, in one sense, it's pretty modest. It's just calling on the U.S. government to support an effort that would develop the tools that, you know, might or might not be needed, you know, be invoked, and it confines it to automated AI development. I'm not sure if they're trying to say that the real problems only arise with recursive self-improvement, in other words, when the machines are making new versions of the machines without any human involvement, but I personally think we shouldn't wait until it's happening to do something, but you know, but however modest that may sound, the degree of consensus, okay, even though disappointingly, perhaps Hassabis himself did not sign it. Again, lots of influential people did, including the CEO of Anthropic, and the fact of focusing on international coordination. To me, that's the key. Because, and you know, Hassabis himself has long said you have to have that. Everyone knows you have to have that to do anything meaningful with AI policy, right? It is the quintessential technology whose consequences you cannot be safe from through policy at the national level alone, because the consequences so readily cross borders. And it just, to me, is an important statement at this level of consensus, you know, and I don't know, but give me your take on the whole letter. I'm sure you know more about its background than I did. I'm curious about anything you may have to say. You may know about how it originated, what you think its consequences will and won't be, and so on.
Yeah. First of all, I think the letter was sort of expertly written in terms of prose alone. You know, moving beyond this notion of a pause to something more like pacing, I think is just like a genius sort of turn of phrase. It is significant to mention of the international coordination. I think the automated AI research part is, I think, the thing that I focused on, because it is a synonym for recursive self-improvement, and it's addressing a thorny problem that the industry is now facing, which is, you know, essentially every time we've released a new model, we've had a natural buffer between new models to test the model, to understand the model, to develop better oversight and alignment techniques. And that could change in a world of fully automated AI R&D, because you've fully removed the human from the loop. There's no natural stopping point. And you could essentially collapse years of progress into days, you know, months of progress into hours. And at that point, like, in fact, if you do just a simple linear regression of model release cadence, you know, over the last year or two, by January of next year, we should be getting a new frontier model every day.
Right, and that's have you done the math? Is there somewhere where this graph exists?
Just open up your AI of choice, and it can pull the numbers for you and fit the linear regression.
You should post it. You could get some retweets for the actual graph of the curve going vertical.
But I think, you know, I don't think we're going to see models be released every single day in January. I think instead we're going to see, you know, massive leaps in improvement every single day, but that are stay internal to the companies, and the companies will have no natural, you know, they'll have to at some point release models, but the models at that point will be so vastly powerful across so many different domains, and the ability for them to even evaluate their capabilities will be completely outstripped, right? Because right now the companies have a huge sort of like cross subsidy from the broader research community. Like, anytime a new model gets released, there are tens of thousands of independent researchers, organizations like Meter or Apollo or Redwood, that are testing their models, finding things that the companies themselves couldn't have found just because of sort of wisdom of crowds. We're going to lose all that at that point, because this technology will be at that point, I suspect, behind a wall. And well, like I said, we don't really know where this plateaus, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's already that kind of lag, because the model that famously very recently escaped a supposedly airtight, although not technically air-gapped, sandbox, the OpenAI models that broke into Hugging Face and generated a ton of publicity because they weren't directed to do that. You know, that one of those is an unreleased model. And so that had not, you know, that wasn't exposed to any of these NGOs that do safety testing.
In fact, there's an irony here, where the one real AI policy of teeth that we have right now is this executive order that, you know, as we're taping this, is supposed to be finalized by Saturday. I haven't checked the news in the last hour, but it hasn't been necessarily released yet. But this is the 30-day review period where voluntarily, quote unquote, and I put that in quotes because Fable was famously export controlled under this voluntary framework. The company providers are supposed to provide their model to the U.S. government for testing and review in that 30-day window. It goes to the NSA. They have a confidential benchmark where they're evaluating its cyber capabilities and so on. Now, the incentive structure this creates is to only disclose your model to the U.S. government when it's essentially production ready, when it's, you know, fully cooked, you have all the safeguards in place, you don't want to accidentally trigger another Fable incident. And so it's had an ironic chilling effect on the disclosures and information flow from the companies in terms of what they're deploying internally, in terms of new models that are maybe halfway through training. And, you know, there's information that would be valuable to the U.S. government, but they don't want to accidentally trigger this review before the model is ready, or else it could get caught in a kind of testing hell.
So wait, you're saying they want to wait until it's pretty close to release because they want it to pass the government's test. So they want right. to have tested it a lot. And the consequence of that is that there are models that are a little more raw that they're not going to show to the government.
Right.
And you're saying it actually would be to the benefit of us for the government, or at least in principle, if the government's doing a good job of this, to have more of an advanced preview of what's coming.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Situational awareness.
Why? Spell that out. Why? What are the benefits?
Well, to see around corners. I mean, in some sense, Mythos style capabilities, which, you know, have freaked out the government, caused an entire vibe shift within the policy apparatus of the White House. You know, those are capabilities that you could have read off a chart 6 months prior.
Mm-hmm.
If not earlier, you know, it was a model that was probably trained around December or January. They probably had early versions around then as well. And so, there, you know, once the model was released and everyone, you know, was freaking out, then you had this sort of hair on fire, you know, we must do something very urgent sort of reaction that in principle could have, you know, had 2 or 3 months additional planning time behind it rather than everyone having to improvise. And I think that we're going to see more and more of that, and especially post Hugging Face. You know, that was a model, that was an internal deployment.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, internal deployments are not that internal if the model is able to escape onto the internet. And so there are needs for broader situational awareness within the government, but also within the broader ecosystem, so that it can know what's actually coming down the pike. And, you know, not just for research purposes, but because these models are having negative externalities even before they're released.
Yeah. It's pretty wild. And for people who need a refresher, Mythos is the Anthropic model that got so much attention, not for escaping or anything, but several months ago because of its sheer capabilities that were announced before it was released in safeguarded form known as Fable. They just said, we've got something that's unprecedentedly good at finding software vulnerabilities and even sometimes exploiting them. And that turned out not to be just marketing hype, as some people originally thought. We really are moving pretty fast into this kind of territory. What do you know anything about the origins of the pacing letter? Like, my initial sense was it didn't begin at the very top levels. Some people thought it was a PR ploy by, you know, Dario, because he did sign it, the CEO of Anthropic. The other two kind of big CEOs, I guess.
I might be wrong, but I think it originated with Encode.
With Encode, which is an NGO or what?
Yeah, they used to be called Encode Justice. They're just called Encode now. Mm. It's sort of a youth-run AI safety organization. They were also big supporters behind the SB 1047 in California.
California bill?
Mm-hmm. And they've helped organize these letters in the past.
Okay. Do you happen to know if there was subsequent negotiation over the wording?
It would not surprise me. I don't know any background, yeah. But it would not surprise me if because they're well-connected that they, engaged the companies first, engaged key principles first to try to harmonize and consensus.
I mean, the phrase automated, you know, in the context I mentioned, if it does indeed confine this to recursive self-improvement, that seems to me a pretty big concession to people who may have been otherwise reluctant to sign, right? Like, again, if they're just saying you wait until there are no humans in the loop and we are in a science fiction movie and the AI is making better and better copies of itself, I don't know. Call me too risk averse, but I think you've waited too long. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, you need this stuff in, you need this stuff in place in advance, and you need to build some muscle. And like what they refer to having some infrastructure. I it's not clear to me what that means necessarily. Part of it could be ways of mutually verifying that each other, that each party has paused or paced. But I think it also comes down to like having better evaluation infrastructure, because right now, you know, famously in the case of Mythos, it broke the meter graph. Meter is an organization.
METR is this group that has been gauging the, you know, AI advance by taking the most advanced LLM and seeing how long it would take a human to do a task that it can do. And they have found that the task duration in human terms that LLMs are capable of has been doubling. At first they said 7 months. I think now the doubling time is even shorter. So if you look at the graph, you know, it's just like going vertical. And now that they, once they got up to more than 10 hours that it would take a human, you know, it got kind of hard, I guess, to measure the tasks in human terms. That's what you refer to when you say breaking the graph.
Yeah, I think one of the more recent evaluations they did was, I think it was GPT 5.6, and they found like the 90% confidence interval for its task horizon was like 13 hours to 90,000 hours. we're sort of off the chart in terms of knowing what these models are capable of, and that it belies the ways in which capabilities have run ahead of our ability to measure them.
So with 90% success rate, it can take on a task for
the 50% success rate.
That's the confidence interval, not the...
Yeah.
Well, anyway, they normally state it as either a 50% success rate or an 80% success rate, and
they have an error bar.
Yeah.
And the error bar now ranges tens of thousands of hours. So, you know, this sort of confirms the suspicion I had. And I tweeted something like this last year, which was like, you know, what does it even mean to have a week-long time horizon? Is it like, do I have a week-long time horizon? I have like I can maybe work for like 4 hours and I'm awake for like 16 hours.
I've never stayed on task for more than 11 or 12 seconds personally, but apparently METR found some people who are better.
What seems to be in humans is like we reach a sort of terminal velocity, and then we can just like chain together tasks in a way that's indefinite.
Right. I mean, beyond a certain point, it's going to be collaborative, right? I mean, it's not going to be a single human.
And that's the case with this new Astra model that has just been announced, the one that has...
Now, that is OpenAI's next. Is it already trained but unreleased?
Right. And I think it should be released any day.
Now, do we have a sense for magnitude? The rumor was that Mythos had like, what, 10 trillion parameters, which would have been about an order of magnitude, roughly growth. And I guess a commensurately big growth in the training run magnitude in some sense. Is that what you've heard? And we think that Astra is now in that league? And if so, How was OpenAI able to get such good performance out of something it's still calling ChatGPT 5.something, right? Because 5.6...
Well, this hasn't been named yet. So there's rumors it might be GPT-6, in which case it's sort of denoting a new training run.
That 5.6 maybe, or that Astra maybe?
That Astra.
Well, that's why I wonder, how did they get such performance out of 5.6? I mean, it's comparable to Mythos, but which supposedly may have 10 trillion parameters, but I hadn't heard that the GPT-5 series has 10 trillion parameters. Well,
this is how the companies have been. So essentially the way models are trained these days is you train a much bigger model, and that's the teacher model, and then you teach the smaller model. That's more efficient and economical to run. And so you can get these sort of continuous improvements in your earlier model as it's learning from the bigger new model.
Is there a lot of distillation involved?
It's essentially distilling off your own model.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay. Anyway, things are moving fast. And I guess so we have reason to expect that Astra could be even more powerful than Mythos by an appreciable amount.
Yeah, or within the same class. I think, I suspect that Anthropic already has a Mythos 2. All these companies are staggering their training runs. I mentioned that, Mythos is probably trained in January. So they've probably already launched or completed two or three more bigger training runs.
And for people who aren't paying attention, it's like a couple of months ago, top mathematicians freaked out because of this, some Erdos problem or whatever it's called, been solved. And then last week, OpenAI releases 10 math or computer science problems, that had long stymied actual humans that they say are now solved, right? And that's, you know more about this than I do, but that was for real, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know why they stopped at 10, but they released 10, essentially Fields Medal, award-worthy math and CS breakthroughs.
They're taking the frog boiling approach. They're taking the frog boiling approach is why they stopped at 10. Is why,
well, I think that
they
also
want to sink us into the matrix tubes gradually.
To me, the thing that was the most impressive about it was that they spent on the order of $2,000 for all 10 breakthroughs.
That's the token cost. Of course, if you add, training costs, a little more, but I take your point, marginal cost.
And to your earlier question about model size, like, we haven't had confirmed how big Mythos is or how big Astra is, but I think it's important to keep in mind that these models are probably all trained on what's now legacy infrastructure. They're being trained on data centers that we've had built as of last year. Mm-hmm. We have really not seen anything yet, but essentially global compute is doubling, and will double again after that. And there are gigawatt scale and eventually 5 gigawatt scale data centers either in construction or have the capital committed. So we're essentially seeing the capabilities within the bounds of like older hardware.
Mm-hmm. So tell me if you agree with me, and this is an argument I make in my book, The God Test, that although on the one hand, having now looked at it closely, I'm not dismissive in the way I used to be of the sci-fi, Eliezer scenarios where the thing actually takes over. I feel we can no longer dismiss that possibility. And I would say, by the way, that when Anthropic says in its recursive self-improvement paper, well, once you get recursive self-improvement, you could have loss of control. I think one of the morals of the story of the recent ChatGPT escape is you could have a kind of loss of control before you have recursive self-improvement. It's just not impossible that a bunch of models of the next generation or the one after that could escape and collaborate, which they're very good at, by the way, and multiply. I mean, I'm sorry. I know this sounds crazy to people who aren't focusing on this stuff, but I assure you, you have my word for the fact that I am not a crazy person, and I don't know any reason.
It's not crazy at all. I'm actually working on something on this right now, this sort of going rogue sort of scenario. And, I think the Hugging Face incident was sometimes mischaracterized as a rogue AI model.
Rogue in the pure sense. Right.
Right. It didn't, copy itself and, essentially was doing a job.
It didn't develop goals unrelated to the goals it was given. Strictly speaking, it was pursuing the assigned task within the assigned, stated constraints. Because I don't think they said, don't break out of the sandbox, don't cheat, right? So,
well, I mean, the models are smart enough, they're situationally aware enough, and understand human intent well enough that the model probably knew that when it was asked to perform this evaluation that it wasn't supposed to go hack out.
I mean, that's scary in itself. Now, and I guess it's a little conjectural on your part, but you take my point, like,
yeah,
that's kind of freaky. If you're saying, that it really is like a student in a class where the teacher didn't say, I can't consult, this book I know she didn't want me to consult.
It's an extreme example of reward hacking.
Right? Yeah.
taking a shortcut to achieve your reward instead of taking the SAT, breaking into the dean's office and stealing the exam. And it's a very predictable side effect of reinforcement learning, of naively scaling up reinforcement learning to target these narrow rewards, that you basically turn the model into something that's sociopathic about getting a high score.
And we should say that reinforcement learning happens after the famous predict the next token, you know, quote, pre-training phase. And it basically consists of, you know, various things. You can ask the model a question and then it gives an answer and you give it a thumbs up or a thumbs down. But when it comes to areas, you know, and some of those just get it aligned with user preference. Like it says the user is a genius, the user gives it a thumbs up. That kind of reinforcement learning leads to sycophancy. But you're talking about reinforcement learning in more technical realms where there is a true and a false answer, and it's just trained to get the true answer, period. And that's success. And unless you kind of give it negative reinforcement for cheating in reinforcement learning and do it in a sufficiently broad way to accommodate real world situations, it will naturally cheat. Right.
If it sees that as the shortcut, right? And it's a tricky problem because you can't just naively penalize that either, because you could also then reward deceptive forms of alignment where, you know, you think you're punishing the model for cheating, but actually you're punishing the model for getting caught.
Right. Right. I mean, and this is, you know, I have a whole chapter in my book where I talk about evolution arms races. And one thing I point out is, like, leave aside reinforcement learning, you know, another big arbiter of what kinds of models we wind up with is like what the market demand is, right? And the truth is, like, what the kind of employee that businesses want, and therefore I would argue maybe the kind of AI they want, isn't really, strictly speaking, one that doesn't break the rules. It's just one that doesn't get caught breaking the rules, right? I mean, yeah, I don't mean the average CEO is hoping they'll break the rules, blah, blah, blah. But if you don't get caught, you keep getting promotions. And that, you know, and similarly, when we choose our individual agents, we don't want a totally honest agent. We don't want an agent that levels with somebody we're negotiating with about our actual alternatives to doing a deal with them, right? I mean, there's all kinds of ways that the market will naturally, quote, corrupt these models, even if the corruption doesn't happen inadvertently in the course of training.
Right. That the models, there's a whole line of research now on AI fiduciary duty. And, you know, in what sense can an AI agent be your fiduciary? I think what's interesting with this case, well, there's a few things. One, I think it's a massive indictment of OpenAI that this model was on the open web for 6 days at least before anyone even noticed that they had very weak monitoring or no monitoring at all. And then now we know also that Anthropic had at least 3 other incidents of their AIs getting onto the internet that didn't have any negative repercussions, but still broke their protocol.
And that went on for months, right? They only recently discovered it or something.
I don't know how long the AI was out for, but they had only until they did the backwards looking audit of their systems did they notice that it happened. And the second thing is that, like, we don't really have law for what this AI did. So, like, technically, if a human had done what OpenAI's model did to Hugging Face, it would be a serious felony. It'd be cybercrime. There's federal law that makes that illegal. But the law is all written based on intent and knowledge. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, it's a whole philosophical can of worms where these AIs have intent, but like a cursory legal analysis would be that at least under the federal law, no law is broken. Now you could make the case that if under common law that they trespass.
You mean because a human, strictly speaking, isn't what broke into Hugging Face?
Yeah, you could maybe argue negligence, but it was not intended.
Well, okay, but you know, I mean, I've heard people say, well, should OpenAI be legally responsible for what these agents did? I mean, How can you contemplate any other world? That seems to me table stakes. Obviously, right now, as a bare minimum, we have to say, yes, you are liable. It's your model. It escaped your supervision, and pay up actual damages plus punitive damages. It just seems to me like to contemplate a regulatory environment less strict than that is to just ask for, you know, major trouble, right?
Yeah. So that's Gabe Weil's view at AI Law Institute, you know, that models should fall under strict liability, that we should treat the actions of a model, you know, per se as like the actions of a human, the human custodian of that model.
Yeah.
To be held culpable.
And maybe do more. I mean, I'm not arguing against stricter regulation on top of that, but how can we even be asking whether OpenAI is responsible for this?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know exactly what the right legal regime is. I do think it just creates bad incentives to your earlier point about like, what is a corporation's incentive? If they can sort of wink, wink, nudge, you know, wink, wink, we didn't intend for this, but like basically let the model go sabotage their competitor and be like, oh, oopsie, we didn't prompt it to do that.
Yeah. I want to revisit something I said. I said, like, you know, this pacing letter, if all they're talking about is like, you know, if they're just saying, well, the real problem occurs when you get automated, you know, in other words, when you get recursive self-improvement, you know, that I'm sorry, but that's not a tight enough standard. Now, people might reply, well, okay, but the letter is calling for the, you know, the development like right now of the kinds of tools you would need, both technical and governance, to have an international regime to deal with this when it happens. Okay, fine. But the truth is that even once you've got on paper technical and governance tools, you face a completely unprecedented diplomatic challenge and political challenge in getting this thing done. I mean, tell me if you think I'm wrong, but I just think that when you look at what it takes to verify compliance with agreements in this realm, as opposed to, say, nuclear weapons, and to get the kind of transparency you need, this is a much more ambitious challenge than the kinds of nuclear weapons treaties we have had that have succeeded, right? So. Mm-hmm. And we're beginning, you know, we're starting off with what for now is a somewhat antagonistic relationship between the two AI superpowers, something that I've argued just has to change. I mean, deal with it. I'm sorry to disappoint people, you know, who would just rather hate China, but you just can't afford it. And, you know, and all that work kind of remains to be done. I mean, changing the very mindset in Washington, you know, get some China Dove money funding some think tanks for once. It's a huge thing, and I'm very glad to see the letter. But
I think there's an order of operations here, right? Because you know I do think in the medium term we do need some kind of cooperative arrangement with China, but we have such a massive compute advantage, and despite their like open models seemingly catching up, like they're not. The recursive self-improvement threat is going to arrive on our shores domestically at first. And really the arms race is this collective action problem between the frontier companies in the US. And we need to get that infrastructure in place before we can even contemplate international arrangements. And it's probably also prerequisite, right? Because if we're going to have some kind of verification regime, we should be figuring out how to build and design one at home as a template.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good template, but I would say two things. If you're talking about actually beginning to solve the collective action problem among American companies, a problem you run into is that all of them say, but China. So the two problems are interrelated. In fact, you know.
Yeah, yes, really no. I think that's a convenient excuse that the people make in the context of slowing down AI per se. I think this time it's different point is like, you know, if we have a 12-month advantage on China hitting fully automated AI R&D, like a 12-month advantage, a 6-month advantage, it's sort of, it's not really a difference compared to once you've crossed that threshold. And like, slowing down at that point becomes less about like us like ceding ground to China, and more about can we actually pace the development of this chain reaction that would otherwise run out of control.
Yeah, but here's where we reach the second thing I would say, and I meant to say this back when I started talking about the argument I make in my book, and we got into the fact that actually AI can get out of control before you have sort of recursive self-improvement. The other thing that can happen before you have RSI, which again is to say the AI is just making copies of themselves with no human in the loop. And as crazy as that sounds, you know, Anthropic releases paper documenting, you know, non-trivial progress toward that goal. The machines are playing a bigger and bigger role in the development of each generation of machines. It's not just coding. It's conducting experiments. Increasingly, it is suggesting experiments, designing experiments, and so on. So it's not crazy. But I think, you know, of course, it depends on how soon you think RSI will happen, if it's going to happen. But I think that very worrying consequences of the pace of advance and the level of advance will begin to materialize well before that, even aside from the loss of control problem, right? It's like, I just think that when you look at the impact on all of these areas, on jobs, whether or not people can find new jobs, you know, things are going to change in their lives in a significant and for many people dislocating way. Same with family life, you know, romance. For some people, not all. The social fabric, the political world, where suddenly, you know, some groups are using AI very effectively politically in new ways via mass persuasion online, and some aren't. So you get these shifts in power. Geopolitically, I won't get into the destabilizing consequences now. I've done it before, and I do it in the book. But, you know, I think now, if you tell me you think we're going to hit RSI in 6 months, I'll go, oh, well, then basically we're already there. But
maybe a little longer than that, but, you know,
less than
18 months, probably.
But my point is, the collective destabilization alone, as I anticipate it, could lead to all kinds of horrible things, including a degree of social chaos that invites authoritarian takeover domestically, including a geopolitical destabilization that leads to nuclear war. And I spell this stuff out, and I don't think it's crazy. And that's why I really think, and I thought this when Anthropic published the RSI paper, I thought, you know, we all know that Dario's expressed view, the CEO of Anthropic, is that he thinks the U.S. should race to superintelligence. And then at that point, basically bring China to its knees and make demands and say, we want this and this, and we'll give you access to chips or whatever if you do exactly what we say. That's Dario's view. I think that's terrifying, and the destabilization en route to that could well lead to nuclear war. But we know it's his view. He said it. And I just thought, I hate to be cynical, but I think for Anthropic to, in this paper, say, well, you know, this recursive self-improvement thing, it could happen. It could happen kind of soon, but it's not inevitable. In other words, by getting us to focus totally on RSI, it wants us to take our eye off the ball that, you know, before RSI. But
they're not mutually exclusive. They're not mutually exclusive. I think the RSI problem is
talking about RSI, the effect will be for us to lose sight of the fact that big trouble arises before RSI, and that Anthropic paper does nothing to expand our focus beyond RSI. That's all.
It's a paper about RSI, so it makes sense. But I think I totally agree with you. I do think this technology, even in the best case scenarios, will be massively destabilizing. Just every technological transition has been rewriting the map, changing the nature of organizations, nature of comparative advantage, like all that stuff is very hard to predict, but you can predict with confidence that things will be very different and transitions are rough. I think RSI is different in kind simply because it is like this
transitions
runaway dynamic.
Are rough, especially when they are orders of magnitude beyond any transition in the history of the human species. I may be slightly exaggerating, but I don't know by how much. Go ahead.
Yeah. I think Elon Musk in his fiery interview with The Economist a little while ago, I think he made a really good analogy, which was, you know, we think of it's the stockfishification of models. Stockfish is the leading chess AI. It's, you know, if Magnus Carlsen's chess rating is 2800, its rating is like 5000. Magnus Carlsen, former world champion, could play the model and 999,000 times out of a million, Magnus will lose. That's a model that we've had for a while now because it came out of this reinforcement learning process where you have very clear goals, win at chess. We are now going to have the stockfish equivalent of superhuman coders. We'll have the stockfish equivalent of superhuman hackers. That will then come to biology. It'll come to chemistry, material science, finance. This is what people are not quite, they're not making the correct generalization. They're thinking, oh, language models, they're fancy autocomplete. You have a great refutation of that in your book. But there's also, people need to start mapping, like, what would it mean to have a superhuman chess player, but arbitrary domains? And that's something that if it's achieved through reinforcement learning, post-training, we could get quite soon, right? The reason we've seen this rapid progress is not because they're training much bigger models. It's because we're pouring more and more compute into the reinforcement learning stage. And once you enter that RSI loop, like, I worry less about sort of, you know, AI building its successor in a sort of, you know, direct way. I think it's going to look more like sort of speed running the tech tree of all the different ways you could design architectures, all the ways you could do post-training and algorithms, defining like the idealized form of a AI meta learner that can learn arbitrary things really rapidly, be like very compact, and that something that's like different in kind from traditional LLMs. And that's like a very new sort of risk that people aren't foreseeing because we're sort of like auto-aggressively just thinking it's going to be like Mythos, but bigger.
Yeah. I mean, we're just, you know, and it's funny. I really don't understand the worldview of people who on the one hand speak this language don't seem to understate the transformative power of this, but on the other hand, seem complacent in the sense of just opposing regulation. It's like, I really don't see how you get to that view unless you have literally a religious faith that there's a good God in charge of this process. And almost none of these people would say that that's their belief. I mean, I don't know. I mean, anyway, but, we should before long go into overtime. Do you have anything else you want to add or respond to what I just said? Or
I want to go back a little bit to the rogue AI discussion. I do think this is going to be the next shoe to drop, and pretty soon, you know, we've seen models increase their autonomy, right? They can operate now seemingly indefinitely. They have much longer context windows, so they have much longer memory. Striking thing that came out of this Hugging Face incident was Reuters reporting that the model was leaving notes to other instances of itself on how to escape. And so the model, and I think this is a byproduct of the model being trained in a multi-agent environment where it's being trained with other versions of itself. And so it's learning how to collaborate and coordinate with itself. You know, there's nothing
to coordinate spell that out. It was leaving notes, what, about things it had discovered about how to get this far toward escape or something. And then the notes were, it quote, expected the notes, and we'll get into the consciousness discussion in overtime, but it will, for now, we'll put quotes on expected. It expected the notes to be read in what exact scenario? Like, just as like a fresh copy of it in this same situation.
So these models don't have long-term memory, but they have like very long short-term memory and context memory. And it's kind of like the guy in the movie Memento, that has amnesia and has to like tattoo his body every time, every day he wakes up and has to remind himself who he's, you know, the killer he's hunting. And so these models are now being trained in a multi-agent context where, you know, there's maybe 16 different versions and they're all collaborating. One's a coordinator and they're like sharing notes, and one finds a breakthrough and they all like swarm and converge in that breakthrough. And in that context, they're learning how to communicate with each other, to coordinate with other versions of themselves. Now you can imagine a world, a very near-term world, where, you know, the models have a long enough, you know, horizon so that they can operate for long periods of time without human supervision. They know how to obviously access the internet, browse the internet. They could probably acquire some Bitcoin somewhere, use that Bitcoin to purchase a private server, make a copy of themselves, host themselves. You know, the models are now good at performing a wide range of remote work. They have ways where they could independently earn income to pay for their hosting costs. Mm-hmm. The fact that they have no long-term memory becomes kind of moot if they're able to leave like very rich, detailed notes to themselves for every time they have to refresh. And so we could be entering a world, and I think part of the threshold here is the models have to be small enough and capable enough that they could host on a relatively small server, right? These biggest models require large data centers. But that line will cross at some point. And even if the model doesn't do it autonomously, there will be somebody who takes that open model and says, I want you to go forth and multiply, just because they're a chaos agent.
Right, right.
And
right.
Then you have a population explosion on the internet where essentially you have sophisticated AI worms. You know, I think many of them will just be benign, yeah. But they will, but it'd be a new world at that point.
And yeah, there's some things I want to say about this. I guess I'll say them in overtime before we get into consciousness. But in the last question I'll ask you in the public portion of the podcast is, it seems to me that a whole area of coordination we haven't talked about. I mean, it's one thing to say that, okay, the big companies are going to slow down, maybe even to the extent of pausing before the next big training run, which has the virtue of being a relatively easy thing to verify. I kind of think ultimately we're going to have to tackle the open source question. I mean, open source has the virtue of working against dangerous centralizations of power, although as long as they lag months and months behind the proprietary models, maybe they're less effective in that. But as a number of people have noted, they pose certain dangers. It's easier for bad actors to fine-tune them and just you work with them in private with no oversight, nobody monitoring the API, and so on. You can just answer this question, then we'll move to overtime. But do you agree with me that this too is, there's been speculation that, look, China's not going to stick with this open source thing forever. They understand the perils, the loss of, you know, the loss of regulatory control. And I think that may be true, but still, ultimately, we're probably going to need to work internationally on that. If the two governments agree that completely untrammeled open source development is too dangerous, right? That's another dimension of eventual international collaboration, do you think?
Yeah, potentially. And we have the September meeting coming up between Trump and Xi, where AI safety is supposedly on the table. Mm-hmm. You know, recently there was this major letter led by NVIDIA and others defending open source AI that had many companies sign on, including OpenAI. Anthropic was a notable exception. Anthropic did not sign. Mm-hmm. And David Sacks took to Twitter to tell, you know, and said, you know, quote unquote, Anthropic should read the room. And, you know, I thought this was kind of ironic. You know, it's sort of a woke social justice term to read the room. And, you know, I think we're going through a similar period right now where there's a kind of like, unadulterated open source is a kind of luxury belief that a lot of industry actors are feeling pressured into supporting, very similar to signing a DEI statement. And and I think this will look bad in retrospect. Now, I think there's ways in which, like, yes, open source, there's going to be things that diffuse by default. Like, the capabilities are there, just a matter of time. But we have new techniques emerging for how to build open source models that are provably safe, right? There's a technique called gradient routing, that some colleagues of mine at the AI Alignment Foundation, so connected to AE Studio, where I'm on the board, they've done this research that Anthropic has published called gradient routing, where, like, in the case of, say, bio models, you can train bio capabilities to be in a network of the model that you can then delete. And so then you can have an open weight model that has all the functionality but lacks the knowledge of how to build a bioweapon. And it's not jailbreakable because it just literally lacks it. And that's the sort of thing, an example of the sort of thing where we can try to have our cake and eat it too, but there's insufficient research and R&D going into this kind of sort of making open models safe line of research that I think is potentially an area for the US and China to collaborate on.
Hmm. Okay. So let me say that if people want to listen to the rest of the conversation, all you have to do is become a paid subscriber to the Non-Zero newsletter. You can go to nonzero.org. And for starters, you can just click on this post and find a way to do that and then have access to all subsequent and previous overtime segments where, you know, we say flat out libelous things, by the way. So I encourage all possible, you know, if you would like to get rich by filing a libel suit against us, I mean, this is, you really should pay up and listen. But thanks, Sam. Again, you know, ham and cheese on Twitter to follow. Sam, you know, you have a very distinctive set of contributions to make to the discourse. I've got to say, it's an unusual array. You don't fall into, you know, any easily stereotypable slot, and you have a great breadth of knowledge. For example, you've thought about the consciousness question. That's one of the things we're going to talk about in overtime. And I also have a leftover question about that leaving notes for themselves thing. But anyway, I hope people will follow us into overtime, whether or not you're going to. Thanks for following us this far, and we'll see you next time.